Welcome to Olin, a straight-shooting, science-based podcast about periods, fertility, and nurturing health outside of unrealistic beauty expectations. We will mostly, but not exclusively, focus on hypothalamic amenorrhea, HA, a component of the female athlete triad, and relative energy deficiency in sport.
I'm Dr. Nicola Rinaldi, scientist and lead author of the book No Period, Now What? I specialize in helping people understand how their eating, exercise, and lifestyle habits are keeping them from hormonal health and their best life. My work focuses on regaining periods, improving fertility, and breaking free of the rules of underlying diet culture.
My name is Florence Gillet. I'm a certified eating psychology coach and the founder of BeyondBodyImage.com. I specialize in mental recovery, helping people let go of toxic health beliefs to finally feel at ease in their bodies at any size.
Every 2 weeks, the All In podcast brings you real recovery stories, expert insights, and new scientific research on HA, hormonal health, and fertility, with an unmissable touch of body respect and women's empowerment.
Just a reminder that this podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and their guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. It is for informational purposes only. And because each person is so unique, please consult your healthcare professional for any medical questions. Music by the Andy Shulman Band, available on Spotify. So hello, Nicola. How are you today?
Doing really well. It's a lovely evening here in Boston, Massachusetts. It's supposed to be 77 degrees tomorrow. So super excited to be outside. And I'm also so excited to introduce our guest for today, who's Virgie Tovar. I basically squealed when she responded to our email and said, yes, she would be on the podcast with us. So this is a fantastic opportunity for all of our listeners to learn a little bit more about body positivity and fat activism. So Virgie is an award-winning author, activist, and one of the U.S.'s leading experts and lecturers on weight-based discrimination and body image. She has a master's degree in sexuality studies with a focus on the intersections of body size, race, and gender. She's a contributor for Forbes, where she covers the plus-size market and how to end weight discrimination at work. Virgie is the author of You Have the Right to Remain Fat by the Feminist Press in August 2018. Fabulous book. If you haven't read it, you need to go and get it right now. And The Self-Love Revolution, Radical Body Positivity for Girls of Color, New Harbinger Publications 2020. I haven't read that one, but I will. And also hosts her own podcast called Rebel Eaters Club. So Virgie, thank you so much for joining us today. It's so lovely to meet you and to have you on our podcast.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So yeah, I think we wanted to start this podcast by asking you if you could tell us a little bit more about what led you to become this kick-ass author and activist you are now.
Thank you. I think that the path really for me started out really personal. I mm-hmm. was a fat kid, a fat baby. I've always been bigger, and I didn't grow up in a home where that was a negative thing. My body was celebrated, and I was celebrated and really loved and encouraged to eat and like all these different really beautiful things. But eventually, like a lot of people, I went to school and I learned fat phobia at school, and I just learned that something, right? Like I was taught that something's wrong with my body, and that the reason that people were so mean to me was because I ate too much. It was just it was really reduced to this idea that I just had the wrong relationship to food. And that's why I was targeted. And I really internalized that and, did what a lot of people in that position do. I tried to become a thin person. And I really think of it as like, telling a tree that it's supposed to be a dandelion or something, or whatever, telling a cactus that it has to turn into a rose. They're just entirely different things. Of course, I always quote unquote failed. No matter how much I starved myself, I just never seemed to be small enough or eat as like, it never felt like enough. And I really felt like a failure. And then I was really lucky to be introduced to fat activism in my late 20s. And it was by happenstance. Like you mentioned in my bio, I was I was studying sexuality studies, and I ended up doing research on the intersections of gender, race, and size. And it was through the research process that, you know, that I found it by just, I felt, again, very lucky. I could have ended up doing that research and maybe never found it, but thankfully I did. And it just opened up my whole world, my whole mind. And I began, I mean, the activists around me began to teach me, you know, this is, you were taught something, it's called fat phobia. It's a form of discrimination. Mm-hmm. It was wrong. It was never your fault. There's nothing wrong with you. You don't have the wrong relationship to food. You're perfectly fine. And actually you can work with us, and we can work together to end fat phobia and diet culture. And I just felt like I had found, for me, it was like the lottery moment, you know, like where I just felt like I had won life or something. I just was like, I can't believe this exists. What a magical, incredible thing. And I just dedicated my life to it ever since, because I just think it's so important.
Absolutely. Wow. I mean, so it's something that I've also come across having written my book. So I, you know, my book is about women who have lost their periods and trying to recover it. And a lot of it stems from people under eating, under fueling for the same reasons you described, because of this fear of being in a larger body that pervades our society.
Yeah.
And so I've, you know, since writing the book, I've sort of learned a lot more about fat activism and come to find, you know, fantastic people like you and the other folks who are out there. So it's really opened my eyes as well to, you know, a whole different world and a whole different way of thinking about the world and our bodies. So many people don't even really know what weight stigma or fat phobia are and how harmful they are for all of us. Could you tell us a little bit more about what those really mean and how they're felt at different levels?
Fat phobia is, there's sort of this ongoing debate. Some people say fat phobia doesn't exist because fatness is, quote unquote, a preventable illness. So therefore no one can have a phobia against someone who's willfully ill. It's just a matter of you choosing ill. And so I think that there's certainly the camp that says fat phobia isn't a real thing. Because this is really a health matter. It's not a matter of hating higher weight people. It's a matter of everyone wanting to be healthier, everyone wanting you to be healthy. But in actuality, I do find that health narrative is really a masking or a dog whistle narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In actuality, when you look at the criteria for discrimination and bigotry, the attitudes and behaviors expressed towards higher weight people is 100% in alignment with discrimination. And I kind of want to get into what that looks like. I mean, to begin with, there's a wage gap. Plus size women on average make between $9,000 and $19,000 less per year than their straight size counterparts. Plus size people, higher weight people get pushed into jobs that are more physical and lower paying, often care jobs. And slender people are more likely to end up in client-facing desk jobs that are higher paying. And some of that has to do with just the attitudes, which researchers have really pretty extensively documented around this belief that higher weight people have less leadership potential, are less intelligent, are less disciplined, et cetera, right? Like, I mean, I remember a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago now, there was a professor who tweeted that that higher weight PhD applicants need not apply because they just don't have the
discipline. Seriously?
Yeah, they don't have the discipline to complete a PhD. And I think what's amazing is like the response was that, you know, hundreds of fat people with PhDs started a hashtag and started posting images of themselves in their like doctoral, gowns. Yeah. It was pretty great.
Strange. That worked for me though. Yeah.
But those kinds of attitudes are really pervasive. And I think one of the ways where it really shows up is around medical care. So doctors mm-hmm. and people in the medical field have some of the highest recorded or researched, most acute weight biased attitudes of people in any profession. And this ends up really affecting a lot of things. First of all, higher weight people are less likely to go to the doctor because they're really afraid of being fat shamed and feeling like they've failed. Like, I mean, I've talked to many people who they feel afraid if they go to the doctor, if they've gained weight or they haven't lost weight, which again, we know from research that longitudinally, a higher weight person is less than 1% likely to be ever become a quote unquote average sized person according to the BMI. It's not a matter of personal failure. It's a matter of our bodies, their body diversity is a real thing. And higher weight people, it's like again with the metaphor of plants where I'm like, it's just a different species. We're not all the same kind of person. We don't all have the same shapes and sizes. We have different mm-hmm. kinds of muscles, different skulls, different hair color, things that we kind of know intuitively, but we don't consider body diversity as one of those natural parts of the multiplicity of what it means to be a human being. But to go back to the discrimination piece, it looks like that. It looks like fashion discrimination, like clothing companies just not wanting fat people in their stores. And it's really important to point out that in the United States, at least, and it's on par with the UK, about 70% of adults are actually plus size, are higher weight. And so I think there is this myth, there's this belief that there's a sort of a thin majority, but in actuality, it's a myth, right? That thin majority isn't real. But I think the reason why there's this belief that higher weight people are the deviation from the norm, when in fact we're not, is because the body type that we see 99% of the time is actually about 1% of the human population. We see that so much. And so even though we kind of know when we walk out in our neighborhood and we see the bodies around us, they look nothing like the bodies on television, and yet, on mm-hmm. billboards and magazines and on social media and the models and all this stuff, right? But our brains, through exposure, it's kind of that the science is really interesting around this, but essentially, when you're exposed to visual media, your brain kind of accepts that as like normal. Mm-hmm. And so even though there's all this countervailing, like this data around us that says is actually not normal, we still believe that it is. And so it creates this sense that very, very, very slender people are the norm, when in fact that's not the case. And so anyway, that's kind of like in terms of how fat phobia on a societal level looks, it looks like that. It looks like the fact that in either 48 or 49 out of 50 US states, fat discrimination is perfectly legal. That's what kind of the live reality looks like. But I guess I should say, like, on an institutional grand scale, I think when I think about on the ground, when we talk about what that looks like, it looks like a perpetual sense of alienation. It looks like mm-hmm. kind of it looks like a fear of being rejected, not even just romantically, but friendship. It looks like, not being able to find, I was just writing about this, like the, like not being able to find an outfit that you can go into an interview with your head held high, or an outfit that you can meet your partner's parents with pride. Or, I mean, I think it's even mm-hmm. like the fear that maybe your partner, is totally fat positive or just weight neutral, whatever. And they're like so down with you being whatever size you are, but you don't know if their parents are that way. You don't know if their grandparents yeah. that way. You don't know if their childhood best friend is that way. You don't know if their auntie is that mm-hmm. way. And so it's just like this never ending sense of like gatekeeping approval. It just doesn't stop, right? Like every single time you meet a new person, you're anticipating that rejection. And that sense that any member of their life could decide that you don't deserve to be with that person just because you're fat. Mm. And I think like that sort of obviously, it's really painful. And I think it's just like that ongoing sort of erosive, just death by a thousand cuts, you know, like all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think the higher you are on the weight spectrum, the more that is your lived reality. And I really do think for people who are higher on the, again, it's sort of like geographically, this varies a bit, right? But like, you know, the higher you are on the weight spectrum, the less privacy you're afforded. I mean, literally, it's like, you know, it's like if you are above a certain size, I really do feel like society thinks that it has the right to comment on your body, mm-hmm. disparage your body, like feel some kind of sense of ownership of your life and your dignity. And so mm-hmm. I think it's really important to understand that there's like these eagle eye, like these sort of grand implications, but there's a very personal level that's really, really hard. And the last thing I want to say is I usually encourage people to think of fat phobia in three different dimensions. The mm-hmm. intrapersonal, which is how we see ourselves, the interpersonal, how other people around you treat you based on your body, and then institutional, which is the ease with which you can or cannot navigate society. Like, can you just go, mm-hmm. like, I'm planning a trip right now. Many of the travelers who are coming with me, most of them are plus size. And I just think about like the level of anxiety, like, is the seat going to sit? Is someone going to say something to me on the airplane? Am I going to be able to be in a bed where it's comfortable? If I break my foot, is there going to be a hospital that accommodates my body size? Right. And I just think like, those are the kinds of questions that are just continuously cycling through. And that's really the institutional side of things. Mm-hmm.
It's just so violent. I think that's why we also wanted you on, because I don't think that many of the people in our group understand how many discriminations people are facing on a, almost, not even a daily level. It's like a minute level.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I think it's quite important. And, I'm just interested, to hear from you, like, what is the role of diet culture in all of this? And if you can define for us maybe diet culture, because I know that again, a lot of people come to us just not knowing steeped. At all. Yeah. They're so, you know, and that's the thing about diet culture, or thinking that there is no such thing as fat phobia, is that you don't even are realizing what's around you. Right. Yeah. So you just keep doing what you're supposed to do. And I think your story shows that as well. It's kind of the big light bulb moment where you're like, hang on a minute. I don't have to do all these things. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So would you be able to tell us a bit more about diet culture, what it is and how it's really hurting all of us? Obviously, the larger you are, the more you are hurt. And I don't want to remove that experience at all, but it's still hurting all of us, because we wouldn't have people losing their periods mm-hmm. if diet culture was not constantly telling us these things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that I feel like you kind of hinted at like the way that I think about it, which in a lot of ways is like, it's like the water around you. If you're a fish, it's like the air. Mm-hmm. I think what makes it a culture is the fact that it takes effort to even see it. It takes effort to even take a step back, to have even a bit of space from it. We can't really get out of it. I really think of it as like, we're inside of it. Like there is like, I mean, I often use the phrase of like break up with diet culture, but in actuality, right? Like, I mean, it's like trying to say break up with the planet Earth. Like it, you know, at this stage, you can't really create a little boat and fly away or whatever. But yeah, I think, you know, diet culture, I think different people would define it differently. I think for me, it's sort of, like, I want to unpack a little bit each word, right? I think about like diet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Diet is this interesting word, because I do think that people think of dieting as this sort of simple, maybe even fun, almost like uniting team activity. Like, I mean, really, I think people think of it as sort of like this running joke. I just remember, for example, I'm having this memory right now. As a kid, I used to watch The Cosby Show all the time. And one of the most famous episodes of the show is the one where Claire Huxtable has hired sort of a personal trainer to keep her on track with her diet. And they end up having this moment where they're fighting over a crouton because Claire is like, literally, like she's like, you know, they have a whole fight over this crouton. And I think what's interesting is like, even as a child, I was maybe like 8 or 9 when I saw it, and the laughter, it was like that. It was like everybody knew, everybody in America knew that joke, quote unquote, you know? And I think there's something, looking back on it as an adult feminist and an adult woman, like there's something so humiliating and debasing about that. And the fact that we sort of make light of this is really indicates something really wrong, you know? So anyway, but like, I think diet, people think of that word diet as sort of just like something that you do. You're a woman and therefore you diet, or you're a person and therefore you diet. But in actuality, when you really look at it, I've been increasingly really asking, what is the difference between a diet and an eating disorder? How long do you have to diet? How much do you have to diet before you can really start calling what you're doing disordered eating? And I don't really understand. Obviously, there's the diagnostic statistical manual that would sort of tell you at which point it becomes an eating disorder. But I think for a lot of people, they either have subclinical or clinical eating disorders and just think that they're dieting. Just think that they're participating in a totally normal cultural recreation activity or something. And I think about the ways that like weight loss challenges are at work. Weight loss challenges are things like women bond over these things. I think like I really like to unpack and talk about this word diet and really, really ask, you know, what are we really talking about here? But in general, I would say any restriction-based eating behavior that's meant to shrink your body in some way, right, is sort of a diet. And then a culture, I really do think for me, what marks a culture is the ubiquity of it. It's just like you just can't escape it. And so together, diet culture is sort of that inescapable reality where weight loss is considered positive pretty much by any means necessary.
Absolutely.
So I think the idea that it should begin very early, it should begin, you know, I mean, I think even like at the point of pediatrics, right, at the point of childhood, that children should be monitoring what they eat in order to try and become thin people, which again is completely unsubstantiated by data. And I kind of want to take a step back into diet culture and just say, our attitudes toward all of this, right? Like dieting, not substantiated by evidence. Weight loss, not substantiated by evidence. Weight loss and dieting, they are not correlated with weight loss. They are correlated with depression, anxiety, and an increased likelihood of developing a clinical eating disorder. That's what those things are correlated with, according to the evidence. I think about like, I mean, just all of it. I think what's really staggering is you get deeper and deeper. I mean, I've been doing this work for 10 years. I've read so much of the literature. And it just continues, the waves of disbelief just over and over and over again, because I'm like, none of this, not only is it destroying people's lives, it doesn't even make sense. Or like, there's not even research that backs any of these attitudes, any of these behaviors. And I think what I've noted in general, when something that is a very popularly held social belief doesn't match up with data, logic, evidence, it usually means it is serving a social purpose that is likely oppressive in nature. And I mean, that's what this is, right? Like in every conceivable way. That's what, I mean, really dieting is capitalism with the body. Dieting is the prison industrial complex with the body, right? It's entirely based on discipline, punishment, the fear of death.
So much punishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And I think, you know, truly like this whole conversation, diet culture has managed to make us believe that food, which is something we need to survive, will kill us. And it is really gaslighting. It's really horrible, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so many people have all these food rules that they've come up with based on things that they hear from, you know, social media or, you know, digests of research, you know, a single research study about, you know, carbs in one small population is translated somehow to nobody should ever eat carbs because they're going to immediately get diabetes and explode or something like that. So,
No, I mean, going back to the sort of discipline, punishment, prison industrial complex thinking, I mean, it really is like diet culture is super colonial in its ideology and its framework, in the sense that it turns the body into an other, and it says that this other, if you do not control every single thing, it will become uncontrollable and it will destroy you, which is exactly how racialized people across the globe have been treated throughout the history of colonialism, you know?
Yeah. And I'm really glad that you're talking about this, because I find that in a lot of ways, when we speak to people that have lost their period and try to support them into seeing all of these things, they soon realize these are not my values.
Right.
Like, I don't abide by this. Like, I don't believe that other people are dangerous or that, you know, they should be controlled. So slowly they start also seeing, hang on, what I'm doing doesn't make sense because it doesn't make sense on a scientific level. It doesn't make sense. Like, I can feel I'm not well, right? Yeah. The reality is people who have lost their periods because they are dieting extremely, a lot of them might not be registered as having a clinical eating disorder, but they are very impaired, both on a mental level and a physical level, because if you don't actually have a cycle and you have a uterus, this is problematic for your whole health, you know? So I think slowly, slowly, when they start unpacking this, they can see, they're like, this is not me, right? I'm not, I don't want to be a part of this. And so I find that, you know, being able to explain all of these things is really, I'm so thankful for the work that you do and many other fat activists, because we just need to hear this message over and over again for people to understand that it just doesn't make any sense.
So, Virgie, so one of the things that really spoke to me about in your book, The Right to Remain Fat, was the idea of internalized inferiority. That was something that I think that so many of us carry around because we're constantly told that we're not good enough. We don't meet these societal expectations. We're not thin enough. We're not pretty enough. We don't, you know, I mean, on so many levels, we're never, ever enough. And so I really found the questions that you asked in the book to sort of highlight that were fascinating. So a couple of them were, today, are you wearing something that is physically uncomfortable because you think it makes you look better? Which I know people do all the time. I think about high heels, like women wearing high heels. I mean, why do we do that to ourselves? And today, did you deny an impulse to say yes or no to something because you were worried that someone wouldn't like it if you did? So, you know, I think, again, everybody should read your book. It's amazing. It's so eye-opening. But we'd love it if you could tell us a little bit more about how internalized inferiority manifests and how it, you know, how it's hurting all of us.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, right, like internalized inferiority is like, I'm going to unpack the words a little bit. Like, I think internalization is when sort of an idea becomes something that's sort of outside of you into something that gets incorporated into your brain, your cells, and how you see the world and how you see yourself. And so we live in a culture that says that women are inferior, that dark-skinned people are inferior, that queer people are inferior, that disabled people are inferior, and certainly that fat people are inferior. In that chapter in the book, I was really specifically talking about gender inferiority. And so, and I want to contextualize, I wrote this book before Trump was elected, when we were, as a country, as the United States, sexism was considered a passé. You know, if you thought that sexism was still a thing, you were sort of a stick in the mud. You were literally like somebody who was kind of like a super far radical lefty. if you still thought that sexism was an issue. And so I want to contextualize and say, like, now that Trump has, we've had an entire term with Trump, there's no denying, but like, I just want to say, like, 4 years ago, I was arguing that sexism was still a thing. So that's why I included it in the book. and the specific example in the book was, like, I had gone to a high school to speak to some students, some young women mostly. And, you know, a very elite high school, very privileged, young people. And I sort of was realizing, I'm like, oh, right. They've been taught that sexism is no longer something that happens, right? Like that they don't experience sexism. And I think what's interesting, I have that sort of thought experiment where I'm like, you know, if I asked you, if you were a victim of sexism, you probably would say no. And you might even laugh, you know, like, of course not. But then when I ask you the follow-up questions, like the ones that you just posed, the answers to all of them are yes. And those are indications of a sense of inferiority, right? Like a sense that you actually don't matter, that other people matter, and that that other people who hold identities that are more cherished and more valued in our society, that their opinion matters more than your comfort or your sense of safety or your boundaries. I think, you know, it's hard to grapple. It's very painful to sit with the fact that most of us have been taught that we are inferior, and then the internalized ideas that we believe it on some level. And I think that you can just see it in so many different, that sense is embedded in all of these tiny gestures, like all across our day, right? Like that first time in the morning when you don't say no, when you mean it, and you don't say yes, when you want to, right? That moment when you're putting on that, like when you're looking through your closet and everything is too small. I mean, I lived that life for so long where it was like, I mean, I grew up, my grandmother and mother, who were both really lifelong dieters, like restrictors. My grandmother has worn a girdle every day of her life. And I remember she raised me mostly. And one of the things that she taught me as a girl and as a woman, which is a rule that her mother taught her, was that you always buy clothes a size or two too small so that you don't, quote unquote, let yourself go. And this idea that you have a little bit of pain every day that reminds you, don't eat that bite. Or like, maybe you should skip this meal, or maybe you should get this option instead of this option. And it's literally like a disciplinary, I mean, I think, again, I didn't think of it at the time in this way, but it's like, it really is like a punitive, I mean, it's sort of like a shock collar almost, you know, where it's like, remember, there's going to be pain if you do this. And so like those kinds of things, those, like, you know, all of that is about inferiority. And I think when we kind of have that realization, like, wow, I am like, I don't know, kind of like when you become, like Michel Foucault has this kind of like cool French theorist, has had this like really amazing sort of metaphor of the panopticon, where he's like, okay, it's based on a prison system where, you know, you could have a prison where there's, let's say, 5 or 10 or 15 gunmen. And if the lights are on, the people, the prisoners will all figure out where the gunmen are, and they will learn how to hide and avoid the gunmen. But if you have one gunman and the lights are off in the tower, let's say, the prisoners can't see the gunmen. They begin to control themselves, anticipating the gunmen everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. And he uses that metaphor of the prison to talk about how we internalize control and discipline. I think that the perfect example is like oppression is like the visible gunman. And then when we internalize, it's when that gunman is us, you know, begin to anticipate that person everywhere all the time watching us, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was reading recently this book called Burnout. Mm-hmm. Did you read it first?
No. What is it?
It's a book by Emily and Emilia Nagoski. Mm. I know she, I think it was Emily Nagoski, who also wrote something about sex. I only read the Burnout one. She is saying women are not raised to be human beings, but they're raised to be human givers. So they say we all suffer from that human giving syndrome because all we want is to kind of give and support and be of service. And so as such, we're not allowed to say, well, no, that doesn't suit me, because if I have to give, then that's all I'm going to gear myself up to, if you see what I mean. And I thought that's so true.
Yeah. I mean, I just think about, like, you know, there's a couple of things I'm thinking of as you're saying that. I'm thinking of, there's this really incredible book called Ways of Seeing. It's written by this person named John Berger. And he has this incredible observation about women in the book. And he says, you know, men see, women watch themselves being seen, or men see, women are seen. And I think that moment, that disembodiment, like when you become the, you know, when you're just aware of yourself constantly as a consumable object, as a visual object or whatever, that is inferiority, right? Like that's, and I think, I'm thinking when you're talking about sex, I was thinking a lot, like I was recently writing something for one of my like courses, and I sort of was like, well, one of the things that happened when I stopped dieting, a lot of things happened. But like one of them was that I went from being someone who wished to be desired to someone who was desiring. And it was like, and it was like that gender treason, that gender law breaking, like to even have autonomy, to refuse to be constantly passive, is to somehow not be a real woman in our culture. And I think, and there's something, I don't know, that shift of, and that kind of that connection with hunger, and how like eating to the point that you're full, and eating for fun, and eating with your friends, and, you know, eating because it feels good, and eating to have comfort, and all those things. Like that is so much about claiming agency. And I'm thinking one more person I have to quote is, like, there's this incredible book called Women and Madness by, I think she's a psychotherapist or a psychologist named Phyllis Chesler. She writes that, that like we live in a society where women are punished for being excellent, and are told that mediocrity is the highest standard, because it creates because that level of suppression is required in order for masculinity to be consistently bolstered. That false ceiling has to be created in order for masculine superiority to be quote unquote possible. And I just think about like that kind of slow gaslighting process of like, you don't matter, what you want doesn't matter, your body exists for other people, you don't get to have pleasure. I mean, that whole thing, you know?
Yeah, I can totally recognize that in myself also, like this idea of going through puberty, for example, and feeling like all that matters is that you're desired.
Yes.
And that if you're desired, you're effectively popular. Yes. It's opening doors to you. So I find that, you know, this is something we have to tell our girls, like from a really early age, that they don't have to just follow the first guy that, you know, is interested in them. And they don't have to say yes to whatever they're going to ask them to do. Yes. So I think it's, yeah. And I'm thinking also of the lack of data around, you know, what women are really doing. So we know that historically, women have done just as many discoveries and important research than men, but typically they are not kept in the books, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, all of that, like having that representation and really fighting the fact that we don't have the whole story all of the time. Yes. So it's really important. And it's interesting that we talk about all of these questions around, you know, bodies and race and food and gender, because this is very much the point of your podcast, which we're big fans of. And I was wondering, because what I hear from the podcast is that our food choices and our bodies are much more than personal choices, obviously, but they're also political.
Yes.
Like how we decide to present ourselves in the world and how we decide to eat effectively, especially if we live in a larger body, they are really strong political choices that we make all the time. So I'm kind of interested to hear like what the whole intersection means for you, and also what it means for people listening to us that are effectively trying to recover from disordered eating.
Yeah, I mean that's a really big question. And I think like for me, the podcast and my work in general is always sort of looking at things as a metaphor, you know? Like for me, food is a metaphor, in the sense that, like, you know, I think there is this idea, right? So let's back up and talk about the sort of construction of food in our society, in Western civilization, quote unquote, or whatever, like Western trajectory, Western world. Food is considered to be fuel for the body, which is supposedly a machine. This is one very specific and again, very Western perspective. I mean, in reality, we know that food is not just fuel. We know that the body, though it has mechanical elements, it is not just a machine. It is not a machine. And so I think when we begin to understand that food is, it's part of what it means to be human. It's something that we use to connect. It's something that holds memories. It's something we can turn to. Like when we're living in with distress, you know, food is one of the easiest things that we can turn to for comfort. And that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And yet I think every single thing that we have where we can access pleasure or connection in our society is heavily regulated and hugely ensconced within shame and control. Mm. And food is like one of those things, right? And I want to back up and sort of talk a little bit about this new research that came out of the University of Glasgow in Scotland. And they sort of found first of all, they found that there were two types of hunger. One that was measured through like one that was physiological, where you could measure through a blood glucose test. The other was psychological and subjective, which was how hungry do you feel, which has nothing to do. You could be completely technically physiologically sated and then actually be very hungry. And I think, you know, and I spoke to the guy who was like the lead researcher in the work, and I said, you know, I'm curious because the research was all about how hunger affects decision making. And I was like, I'm curious of the two types, which one did you find actually had more of an impact in the research? And he said, the subjective one. People could technically be full and still make decisions like they were hungry if they were dieting, right? Like if they were people who, you know what I mean? Like who chronically restrict food. And I want to kind of share like the research found that people who were subjectively more hungry had a much more difficult time making long-term decisions. And it was just because they were in survival mode. Like when you're hungry, again, whether it's physiological hunger or psychological hunger, like all your body is telling you is feed me, please feed me, like feed me. That is the most fundamental human signal of survival that's imaginable. That's the most base thing, right? And I think for me, I'm like just, it just, I can feel it in my whole body talking about it right now. Like just thinking about millions of people living like that every day. And when you're talking about inferiority, that is debasing. That is humiliating to push someone to be in their most animal instinct and to reward them for it, to reward them for it. And I can't tell you how many clients I've worked with who tell me how destroying it is that like the moments when they were their most ill, their most depressed, their most, you know, addicted to something in order to stay thin, whatever, like die. Some of them were dying. Some of them had illnesses that no one understood, right? Gastrointestinal things that doctors couldn't figure out. Right. And people never treated them better. Like I just like that for me is sick. Right. And I think to go back even further, to back to colonialism and back to that intersection, it really goes back to, in my opinion, right? It goes back to this horrible ideology, which was one that, like, you know, and I want to step back and give a little bit of a historical lesson that really was one of the most powerful lessons that I've had since starting the podcast. And it was when the puzzle pieces all came together around one very specific thing, and it was this. So, 1830s, the BMI is invented in Belgium, okay, by Adolf Quetelet, who's sort of like essentially kind of the grandfather of eugenics, right? A little bit, arguably. And so,
I feel really sorry to be Belgian when I hear this.
I mean, right? Like,
so many apologies for.
It was, you know, so it's like Adolf Quetelet, 1830s, right? Same time across the Atlantic in the United States, it is the birth of the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution, right, funded by slavery. Then, same moment, free market capitalism as the prevailing economic ideology, same moment in history, takes over the United States. Same moment as that. So all this is happening at the same time. Same moment as that, a rash of morality and abstinence movements begin to take hold. All of a sudden, sex, food, alcohol are things that are connected, not just behaviors that you do, but they determine who you are. And I think it's important to understand. And again, going back to Foucault, he really talks about this, where it's like something goes from something you do to someone you are. And it's important to understand that the idea that food makes you who you are is not inherent, is not inevitable, and is not ahistorical. It's not something that has existed for all time. So at that same moment, right, like, and it's no accident that like the very men who were at the epicenter of anti-sex, anti-masturbation movements were also at the epicenter of clean eating and food control, and who are the grandfathers of modern day diet culture. And so I think it's important to contextualize. And at the same moment, right, this is also the height of colonialism. And none of this is an accident. All of these ideas are like the all of the violence and the intense stuff that was happening on the ground, all of it required a very sophisticated and very mythological ideology that said people who do this are bad and deserve to be punished or killed or enslaved or their resources stolen or their land taken. And people like this, people who control their appetite, people who control their sexuality, they deserve to inherit the earth. And that is the ideology that literally is that's dieting, that's diet culture. I mean, it's the same thing. So I think it's important to understand, going back again, something I said earlier, where it's like, you know, dieting is capitalism with the body. Dieting is colonialism with the body. And you think about it, right? Mm-hmm. Again, capitalism is technically about money, right? Colonialism is technically about resources, let's say, I think it's more than that. But like, you know, all these different things, but it's like, I use the metaphor of the house of cards, right? You can't just have a roof of cards. You can't just have a ceiling of cards or a floor of cards or one single card holding you have to have the whole thing has to be made of cards. And that's why, that's why, you know, you can't have people living this brutal economic reality and then just being able to eat whatever they want. Oh, have fun and masturbate, have sex, enjoy pleasure. But don't forget economically, this is terrible and you've got to do this. It's horrible, awful, dehumanizing thing. You just have to do that over here. But over here, you're just free as a bird. That doesn't work, right? That will like literally create cognitive dissonance and it will lead to revolution. So what do they have to do? They have to make you do all the stuff with all the things. You got to do it with sex, got to do it with food, got to do it with love, got to do it with like money, you know? And so I think this is what people don't often when, you know, I'm trying to help people understand the enormity of it. It really is a matter of like, you can't have loose strings when you're running a racket as big as this one. You know what I mean? Like, think about the mob. Like, you can't let a single witness live. It's the same concept. Mm-hmm. I know that's really dire, but it's true.
We love metaphors on this podcast. We're really into whatever you're talking about.
So how do we go about pulling down this house of cards? How do we fight the fat phobia and everything else that is surrounding it?
Right. I mean, gosh, that's a huge question. I mean, obviously I have some of my ideas that I think about, like on the one hand, and I always, whenever I give advice or, you know, tools, I always have the disclaimer, which is I'm like, it's not your fault and it's not your responsibility to fix fat phobia. Like it sucks and it's not fair. It's never okay. It's never right. And it's never your fault. Like fat phobia isn't something you asked for. It's not something you should have to fix. And I think sometimes the empowerment narrative ends up being re-victimizing. I think there is this belief that if you have the right attitude that you can just make your way through anything. And I'm like, no, I can love myself all I want. And I will never, right? I can't fight race. I can't take that to the bank and end racism with my self-confidence, right? No matter how much I love my body or how much my partner respects me, or like we cannot, end it, like we are still living in a reality of fat phobia, of sexism, of white supremacy, right?
Capitalism.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And so I just want to say, like, that's really, you know, I think for people who are experiencing fat phobia, if we can do something even small that gives us dignity or joy, that's enough, right? That you survived and that you didn't just like utterly cave into this horrible reality. That you're here one more day. Like, I want to say that's enough. And I think for people who are really invested in kind of bringing it down, there's so many different ways that can happen. I mean, to begin with, I really want to go back to the model of like the intrapersonal, inter and institutional. We can always look to all three of these, right? Like when you think about intrapersonal, it's really about recognizing that fat phobia is a trauma, no matter what your size, no matter if you're actually experiencing fat phobia, you know, acutely or not, recognizing that like the fact that you had been taught that there's an entire group of people. And again, in the US, the UK, places like that, the majority of people are inferior and sick and deserve to be treated poorly. That is devastating to the human spirit. It's mm-hmm. devastating to be taught that. And so it's important mm-hmm. for us to be patient with ourselves, regardless of our body size, right? Like, obviously, higher weight people as well as thin people have internalized fat phobia. It's almost impossible not to have done that. And so to, I mm-hmm. think a part of me is like, you know, be honest with yourself, be accountable if you've done harm, but always be infinitely patient and recognize mm-hmm. that like you were a part of your spirit was stolen when someone taught you that. And mm-hmm. what does it mean to grieve that? What does it mean to like have that sadness for yourself, not even just for another person? And that's where really the intellectual becomes cellular and moves into the heart. So I think that's the intrapersonal work. I think the interpersonal work is sort of like, you know, what in your world do you have control over? What in your world can you change, right? And I think one super simple thing is like today you can promise, you can make a commitment to yourself today that you are not going to talk about people's bodies or how they eat or your body yes. or how you eat anymore. And I think what's so amazing yep. is it's free, it's instant, and the results are massive. You know, so like, and I really think like I've tasked people with this and just said, you know, take a vacation, take a year off like from talking about this stuff. It's okay. Just not even the positive stuff. Just leave it all behind. No negative. Just yes. stop. Just stop. You know, and like the freedom that people feel is astronomical. So I just kind of want to say like, that could be something you decide today. And then I think, right, if you have a little bit, like all of us have a little bit of power. So for example, like if you're in the marketing department, just advocate for body diversity. If you're someone
who's so much.
Yes. If you're mm-hmm. in charge of logistics for events, make sure there are chairs that have like a weight capacity that's above 200 pounds. Make sure there's some chairs that don't have armrests. You know, if you're somebody who works in a bar, make sure that there's no language on the menu that's like uses the word like innocent or shameful or guilty or like doesn't use weird fat shaming food moralizing language.
Oh, that's a good one.
Like literally just you can just do this. Yeah. Right? Like, and then I think institutionally it really is about sort of thinking about, you know, how do we change the paradigm of like of society, right? And I think obviously the first two things, the intra and the inter, obviously you're totally connected to the institutional, but like, you know, always remembering, right? Like, how do we think of the person who's the most impacted? How do we keep them in mind? And how can we, again, like create that kind of societal level change that's really going to help people live life with dignity? And I think especially for people who are in the medical field or who are in the teaching field or like really, I mean, I think what's amazing is we need to see this change on every single level. And I really do think it goes back to like, you know, if you're an undergrad, if you're whatever, like, you know, that you're kind of using your voice in any way that you can, using your resources to try and shift this sort of very, very big institutional reality. And I think what I want to say, what's inspiring is that people have really taken this to heart, and it just blows my mind to see how much advocacy people have done and how much work, and like the nurses who are in their program, like who are training to be nurses and they're in their program fighting every single day, arguing for health at every size, arguing for weight neutrality. Those things really mm-hmm. matter. Be a squeaky wheel. And I just sort of think like we can't, I just remember growing up and I was always told to ignore everybody being a fat phobe as if ignoring them made me a better person. And I don't believe in that. I'm like a big, like somebody, people keep asking me these questions about like, what do we tell children around this, right? And I'm like, tell them to be a pain in the butt. tell them that somebody telling them to ignore oppressive behavior isn't good enough. So I think like all of these things, you know, together can really make a change.
Absolutely.
I love those. Yeah,
I love those. I love the story in your book too about the convention that you were at where that guy was following you and like being nasty and you're just like totally called out on it. It's like sometimes people need to be called out because they're not going to stop otherwise.
And I know.
They get really ashamed when they get called out. It's like, oh, you know, so I think that's a really important point to not just let people sit around and be nasty and not say anything. I mean, if you have that capacity, if you don't, then obviously, you know, everybody has to do what's good for them. But if you have the capacity to call it out, then absolutely.
100%. Like you have the right to defend your body. I think that's really powerful. And at this point, I feel like I'm well-versed and I'm pretty shameless about it. But, you know, I will go head-to-head. Like, for example, yesterday I have two baby Netherland dwarf rabbits. And yesterday we took them to the vet for the first time. And I was like, if that veterinarian says one single thing about their weight, I will go off. And because one of them is a bit bigger than the other one. And so I just was like,
ooh, body diversity.
I know. Of course, like body diversity. And so I just was like, but I was like ready, you know? I was like, I'm going to keep it polite and kind. I'm going to give this person the benefit of the doubt. But if she starts pathologizing this rabbit's weight, I am going to let her know. I just kind of bring that for me. It's just one of those tools. And I think especially, frankly, I learned self-advocacy as a feminist first. Like before I was the fat activist, I was a feminist and I had these incredible, you know, I mean, they were like very much the stereotype of like that sort of like very brusque, unsmiling feminist. And it was the best, right? Like it's the best. Like really, like I just kind of think for me, it was like they really taught me that that, you know, it was my right to fight for dignity and respect. And I really took that lesson to heart.
I can only agree with everything you said. And I think the first part of what you said also about being patient with yourselves, being kind to ourselves, recognizing that we are actually coming back from this traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And that we might have been living with that trauma for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Mm. And you said you have to grieve it, which I thought is really interesting because with a lot of the people we support, both Nicola and I, there's this idea of you have to let go of that thin body that you were dreaming of and that maybe some of the people we accompany actually got to that dream body that diet culture told them to achieve, but it got them really sick,
right?
It got them completely losing themselves and not knowing anymore what they like, what they want, who they are. As you said, like the research about long-term decision, it totally makes sense. So you have to grieve and say goodbye to that body and say, you are not serving me. So thank you so much. Those are amazing steps to take. And I think, you know, the next question I had in mind is very similar to what you just explained. So maybe Nicola, you want to ask our usual question for the podcast?
Sure. So our last question usually is just the process the term that we use for sort of eating more and getting rid of the food rules and the diet culture rules and cutting out the high intensity exercise, we call that going all in. And we think about it not just in terms of those physical manifestations, but also in terms of mentally, like letting go of a lot of this diet culture and really, you know, being all in on our whole lives, because the freedom from dieting and exercise means that you can just participate so much more in your whole life. So we love to ask our guests, like, how are you all in your life right now?
Oh, I mean, yeah, like I feel like I'm all in so many different ways. Like I'm all in when I first decided to pursue fat liberation and stop dieting, stop restricting. I sort of just thought, you know, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to do it in the name of, like, again, dignity, pleasure, humanity, living my life, and all these kinds of things. And also in resistance of patriarchy and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think what was amazing was that it opened up this floodgate, and it opened up a line of communication to my body that, that has totally changed the trajectory of my life. And I just kind of think, like, all in, feels like that feeling that I get when my body says, this is what we need to do, this is what I want. And I just say, yes, I just trust it, you know? And it's so small. Like, sometimes it's so small. Like, I mean, I think before this interview, my body was like, I very much want a delicious grassy ice cream that has a complex flavor. And I was like, okay, we're going to just drive and get some matcha soft serve before this interview. And I'm like, that tiny little thing. Right. And then it, sometimes it goes farther than that. It's like I remember a very hard thing my body told me was, you know, you have to step away from your abusive family, right? Your abusive family members. And it was terrifying. And I didn't want to listen, I think. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I trust you. I have to trust you. And so I think, like, you know, for me, like, it's just that all in feeling is like, whether it's matcha soft serve or it's finding, like, I want to give one more example, which is like, for years in my diet mentality, I was so preoccupied with finding a particular kind of partner in order to feel worthy, like a partner who made a certain amount of money and who looked impressive, and just kind of to prove that, like, I, a lowly fat woman, in fact could, you know, be with somebody who is wealthy and who had this great job and who bet all this stuff. And then I think really coming out of that mentality, it went back to like, oh my God, I deserve to feel comfortable. And a person who has the values that puts them in a position like that usually isn't going to have the values that I have. I've just found in general, right, in my experience, and I was like, oh my God, I feel worthy enough that to know that I deserve comfort in my relationship. And I think that's another thing, right? Like, and so
so important.
I radically changed how I dated and who I dated away from, again, internalized inferiority and towards, you know, I deserve to feel amazing with my partner all the time. Of course, we're going to have conflict. Of course, we're going to be hard moments. But like, I'm never going to doubt my worth in this relationship. And that's the number one thing I started to look for. Again, that was fully my body. And so I think for me, all in, it's like, whether it's the matcha soft serve or it's dating or it's information about family members, I think for me, it's just like listening, trusting, and again, like just being like, holy shit. Like we live on a planet where there's giraffes and palm trees and bumblebees and oceans and things we haven't even seen and discovered or like can't even possibly imagine. And to spend any moment longer than we have to, doing anything besides fully vibrantly enjoying that, like, it's just a tragedy, and I won't suffer it, you know?
Yeah.
This is, oh my God. Yes. And I don't know about you, Nicola, but I find that the moment you trust yourself around food again, it kind of opens up all these different avenues. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy to me that it's just food. Like, if you think about it, that I was denying myself, but it meant I was also denying myself, yes, from good relationships or from the job that made me happy, yes, or from believing that I could pursue whatever objective I had in mind, just because I was not feeding myself or trusting my body. It's mm-hmm. crazy to me. It's crazy yeah. what it gives you. So thank you so much for this answer. I think it's probably the best all-in answer we've had so far. last question is, what are you working on right now that you would like to share with our audience, or where can people find you?
Yeah, so season 3 of Rebel Eaters Club, we just got the green light. We're in pre-production. We're in pre-production now. I'm really excited about it. So if people are interested in listening to seasons 1 and 2, they can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever they mm-hmm. get podcasts. I have a new book coming out in spring of 2022. It's actually a journal. There are going to be stickers and it's going to be really great. And it's essentially, it's a journal for people who want to change their relationship to their body. And I'm just really excited about it. I'm finishing up editing it right now, and it's just going to be incredible. Like one of my favorite parts of the book is there's this essay about how we're basically just like plants, and how we need to see the world the way that we look at a garden, not mm-hmm. the way that we currently see mm-hmm. it, and just sort of, you know, love every single prickle and flower and needle and bark, and understand that it creates this beautiful world. And so I'm really excited about that. And
it sounds amazing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really fun and really good.
Yeah.
And so that's coming out. And then if people want to, I have a few international trips. I guess like we just released a trip to Italy that's like eating and walking through Italy, which I'm really excited about. There's a few spots left. If people I know it's like it's past 50% sold out pretty quickly. People are just really excited, mm-hmm. which I'm really happy about. There's a few spots left. And if people want to follow me, you can go on Instagram. I'm most active there. So at Virgie Tovar, VirgieTovar. And VirgieTovar.com is my website. I teach a few mm-hmm. classes. I have a few online classes that are self-guided that are pretty cool. So you can find out about those on my website or on Instagram as well.
Fabulous.
Well, we'll put all of those in the show notes.
Thank you.
And I'll try to also reference all the different studies or authors that you are talking about, because I think it would be great for people to look a bit more into those.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a pleasure it's been.
Yeah, this has been an amazing conversation, and I hope that everybody listening has learned a ton as I have. So, you know, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, Virgie.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Maybe take a few minutes to reflect on it and how you have been all in this past week. It always strikes me how different each person's all-in journey is. As I often say, there are many paths to HA and many paths out of it. Your journey is unique.
That is so true. And if you need more support on your journey, you should definitely start with No Period Now What, which you can get at noperiod.info/book.
And Florence and I both work with people on different aspects of period recovery and so much more. So if you'd like more personal advice and attention, you can go to noperiod.info/appointments to schedule a time to speak with me on fixing the issues underlying your missing periods and figuring out what those issues are.
And I'm at beyondbodyimage.com to work with me on the deeper emotional issues and your body image. I also run a French Instagram account, aminore_fr. And obviously you can find Nicola at No Period Now What on Instagram. We also have joined clients, so you can access both our domains of expertise at the same time. If you enjoyed this podcast and found it helpful, please drop us a review to help more people find it.
Also, join the No Period Now What recovery support group at noperiod.info/support and let us know how all-in is going for you.
All-in is not just about period recovery, it's about getting your life back. See you in 2 weeks.
You were lost in Babylon, till you got lost again. You were lost in Babylon, now find yourself and then take all that you've learned about what love and loss, pleasure and pain. Never get lost, never get lost again.